I had not intended to preface my sermon, which is a very serious sermon, with this story, but I have a couple of our inveterate male golfers present this morning, and I think it should be part of my ministry that I relate this story to them. There was a minister who had a great deal of difficulty one week getting his sermon organized. He'd had a number of extra activities. And finally, in desperation, about Thursday night, he called his staff and said, "Would somebody preach for me on Sunday? I'm not feeling well. I think I'm going to be feeling worse by Sunday. So would someone do that?" And they said, "Certainly, we'd be glad to." When he woke up on Sunday morning, it was a beautiful day. He liked to play golf. The thought occurred to him that it would be a great morning to play golf. But he couldn't very well play locally. Somebody would be sure to report it. There was a golf course about 50 miles away that he had wanted to play for a long time. And he thought he'd be safe there, so he drove down. Sure enough, there was hardly anyone there at all. Played a couple of holes, gleefully, rejoicing in the beauty of the place and in the fact that nobody was going to know. But he had not been forgotten. God was waiting to decide what to do with him as fit punishment. And all of a sudden, he had it. And when the guy stepped up to the tee for the third hole, a par three, struck the ball, it traveled high and true, bounced a couple of times on the green, and rolled into the cup. And the guy threw his club into the air, shook his fist in jubilation, and then caught on. Who am I going to tell? I won't call you by name, gentlemen, but remember that. I say often that people do not have to agree with what I say in a sermon. I want you to listen very carefully this morning, because I'm dealing with a rather controversial topic, and you will not all agree, but you will be loved anyway. Several years ago, a giant Eastern Airlines jet crashed in the Everglades. 90 people were killed, another 90 survived. A Coast Guard lieutenant flew over with one of the rescue helicopters and said, "I'm amazed anyone lived. Someone must have been watching over them." He meant God, and that should have pleased me, I suppose, because so much of my life has taken direction and meaning from religion. But what I thought was, what an odd watcher. How did he pick the 90 he would let die and the 90 he would watch over and save? That same day, in a related story, a federal aviation official also marveled that anyone had lived, but he had a different explanation. "I can only conclude that the nature of the terrain, the Everglades environment with its shallow water, cushioned the impact." He added that the larger than usual aircraft might also have permitted a higher survival rate in that environment. Which explanation makes most sense to you? An intervention by God that saved half and let the other half die? Or an accident in which location and plane size allowed half to live who would have died if the plane had plunged into a mountain. Was the survival of half the passengers an act of God or sheer good luck? And as you think about it, pretend that your wife or father or child was on that plane and died. Would you like the implication that God plays favorites, choosing one half to save, but not the half your loved one was in? In one of those little devotional magazines I sometimes pick up to know how people are talking about religion, I read about a woman who told how God had singled her out for a special favor. "Once I had a debt," she wrote, "that was too much for me. A hailstorm wrecked the neighborhood, but it did only minor damage to my car and none to my house. But the insurance not only paid the car damage, it also gave me money for a new roof. Even though I insisted that my house was not damaged and they didn't owe it to me, they asked me to take the money anyway." There are some insurance men in this audience. I don't know how often they have seen that happen. Saying that it was easier for them to go on and pay everyone. So I had money to pay my debt. Her point was that God had done this for her. If she had said, "I was lucky, but I do pity the neighbors," I could listen. But she is telling me that because she had an unmanageable debt, God stepped in with a selective hailstorm that spared her roof and then moved the adjusters to tell her to take the money even though she didn't deserve it. Do you find any arrogance in that story? Is there even a twinge of remorse for accepting money she admits she did not deserve? What was it about her that made God work so hard in her behalf? The neighborhood was ruined. Did God dislike all of them? Or was this, after all, an accident? And is it wrong to wonder how often accident is exalted into divine intervention? Perhaps because subconsciously it makes us feel chosen and therefore extremely important. That is, if we can speak of accident at all. In the two approaches to the jet crash, we had an example of our deep division about the things that happen to us. On the one side are those who are positive God can and does intervene to save some while others die. And on the other side are those who think that accidents happen and that there are deep and disturbing problems when we get too confident about interpreting the role of God. When Barbara Mandrell, the country music star, broke her leg in a car wreck a couple of years ago, President Reagan sent a greeting which said, "God must have been watching over you." It was not intended, but the logical implication that God was not watching over others who died in America that day, that he was not watching over the young man driving the other car who was killed instantly. If he had been your son, on what basis would you have accounted for God's neglect? I walked out of a classroom a few months ago behind a girl with crippling deformities. Before I could reach her to help, she tried to open a heavy door which sprang back on her and knocked her sprawling onto the floor. I helped her up and watched her hitch herself awkwardly on down the hall. I thought of how many times that girl had cried in the night because normal dates and romance and marriage are lost through no fault of hers. I thought of how she must have prayed as a child, "Please let me look normal someday. Please let me walk without dragging this twisted body along while people try not to see me." Can you guess at my theological turmoil when a pretty co-ed gushed in a speech an hour later that God had heard her prayers and caused her to win the softball tournament? This inscrutable favoritism, this intervening for one and not for another, is a view of God that I find expressed somewhere in almost every story of a major accident. I collect those stories. Remember the plane that crashed during takeoff in Detroit, with enough dead to make it the second worst air disaster in U.S. history? Well, inevitably, there was the man whose wife and two children had reservations but decided to spend one more day in Michigan, and who declared, "It had to be the work of the Lord saving my family like that." About 150 other families got no such blessing. How did God pick that man's family? Is there a kind of divine lottery? So divorced from our sense of fair play and compassion that we can't understand it? A Kansas family waits to hear whether their son, trapped in the USS Stark when the Iraqi missile struck, is alive. It turns out he is. 37 other sailors are dead, sons and husbands, equally loved. The Kansas couple said, "We just kept praying. That's probably all that saved him." Are we to believe that no one, no mother, father, friend, or minister had prayed for the others? And if so, why did one prayer succeed and 37 other prayers fail? How did God decide? And exactly what kind of faith am I to construct from this? Remember the church kids who died down in Texas when their bus was swept into a rain-swollen river? One survivor, Melissa, 17, from Mesquite, Texas, said, "We had come up here to learn about God, and we sure did. And all that day I wondered what they learned." There was one little girl, only 14, who tried to hold on to a rope from a rescue helicopter but couldn't make it and fell 100 feet to her death. I do not like heights. I can imagine vividly the terror of that little girl's fall. So some lived that day, Some died. What did Melissa learn about God? That he plays favorites? Or that he doesn't? And that life simply has some tragedies that make no sense. Some accidents that defy theological explanation. And there was the 11-year-old boy, Juan Perez, who was mauled to death by polar bears at a Brooklyn zoo after using some poor judgment, as boys of 11 sometimes do. At the Requiem Mass for Juan, the priest, Father Guthrie, said that the boy had a reputation for being a little wild and was getting into trouble. So Father Guthrie explained, God allowed him to enter the cave of an enormous beast and lose his life to a bear rather than lose his soul to the traps of Satan. Perhaps to save his soul, God allowed this terrible thing to happen. I could never prove the father wrong, but the logic of that remark astounds me. I think if only God had allowed Hitler to stop by the zoo to save his soul, 30 million people might still be alive. Dateline, Dallas, 1985. An Austin, Texas chemist who escaped harm in the bloodbath in the airport in Rome last week, the story said, had also survived a massacre 19 years before, the sniping episode at the University of Texas, in which 13 people were killed. His father said, this poor guy has been through this twice. The good Lord must be watching over him very closely. I thought of the bodies sprawled in blood on the floor of the Rome airport. The good Lord, I had to conclude, had not been watching over them. I thought of the 13 killed from the tower on campus and the more than 30 who were injured. The good Lord had not been watching over them. Only over the chemist who was preserved twice according to his father. Could there be a kind of innocent arrogance that tempts us to believe God is looking out after us and ours? Even, hear every word please, even if we must close our eyes to his failure to look out after others? Is it truly Christian to forget that what seems a providential blessing for one party may be a tragedy for another? Now, quite apart from meaning to be funny, a famous old limerick makes the point. There was a young lady of Ryde who was carried away by the tide. A man-eating shark was heard to remark, I knew the good Lord would provide. From the point of view of the shark, divine providence was at work. But I would guess that the girl and her family would see that only as a most unfortunate accident. One more. In June of 1985, a deadly tornado roared across Pennsylvania, killing 60 people It was a very capricious storm. At John's Bar in Evans City, about 70 terrified customers hit the floor when the twister hovered overhead. Buildings close by were destroyed, but the saloon was spared. Surely not all 70 in that bar were heroic role models that God had decided he must work a miracle to save. On down the road in another town, a 32-year-old man saw the storm coming, left his job as an umpire in a little league game, ran into the stands to grab his niece and another child, threw them into a ditch, and covered them with his body. Quick, thoughtful, caring man. But the tornado hit, and when the two children raised their heads, their Savior had been blown away and killed. I read repeatedly in Proverbs that wisdom is a gift from God, that intellect is to be prized as much as feeling and faith. And I do not know how to make sense of life unless some of these freakish things are blind accidents. And the good news is that in the scripture read to us so well this morning, Jesus clearly leaves room in life for accident. He recalls some of his Galilean neighbors who were murdered in church at the altar, right in the midst of their most sacred religious duty. Did this happen, he asked his audience, because these people were all guilty of something and God was punishing them? Not true, he says, and he provides no other explanation for it but as a quirk of fate. And to make the point emphatically, he asks another question. Those 18 people down south in the province of Judea who died when a tower of some sort collapsed on them, was that an intervention by God to punish the guilty? There is no hint in this episode from the life of Jesus that he thought it was anything other than a tragic consequence of something like poor workmanship. Bad luck. A minister claims that this terribly hot summer is God's punishment upon this country for allowing Hollywood to make and show The Last Temptation of Christ. But I think that if Jesus were among us, he would look to the meteorologists for the explanation. He is, after all, the one who said that the sun shines on the good and bad alike, and that the rains fall equally on the just and the unjust. Natural law functions in this world, and sometimes innocent people get in the way and are hurt. This has been a sermon of questions. I do not have answers for all the questions I have raised, but I do think Christianity is diminished by what a character in a short story calls pocket providence. It's a marvelous phrase. It means that way of using God, which is like keeping a comb handy in your pocket for when you need it. It means having a glib explanation for the complex mix of tragedy and blessing in life. It means being able to thank God for saving your own family and friends in the plane crash without stopping to wonder what you are saying about all the others who died. The Christian faith has enough odds against it in the modern world without having to fight the arrogance which claims that God protects my house in the hailstorm, my child in the train wreck, but is blind to the awful mystery of his having failed to protect someone else. Favoritism is too cheap. Whatever the answer is, it's harder than that. What I do believe is that the power we call God is always available, making trust and courage possible, even in the midst of tragedy. I believe that it is not in contravening the natural order that God works the great miracle, but in making it possible for us to learn how much love and friendship mean, and how even in the deepest pain and loss, we may discover a greater self than we had met before, which is to say that creation is going on all the time.